Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'm your host today. It is September 2nd, 2006. On September 6th, Lyndon LaRouche will be delivering an historic address in a webcast where he will be speaking from Berlin. It will be on LaRouchePAC.com beginning at 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And this webcast is occurring at a moment of the most profound strategic crisis in our nation's history. The United States is bogged down in a quagmire in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those responsible for getting us into this quagmire, namely the fascist financial networks behind Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the Bush administration, are committed to expanding this war to spread it to Iran, Syria, and possibly in the near future against China as well. At the same time, the housing bubble has popped, and the air is coming out of that bubble at an accelerating rate. This threatens not only realtors and household spending and the construction sector, all of which are being hit really hard, but the whole banking system is at stake, the whole world financial system. U.S. infrastructure is disintegrating. The auto sector is being dismantled, exactly as Lyndon LaRouche warned it would be in February 2005. At the time, he said that it will be dismantled unless his emergency retooling legislation were enacted and a national bankruptcy reorganization undertaken at once. Needless to say, that has not yet occurred. But finally, at long last, commentators have begun to acknowledge that there is something wrong with the president. One former Republican congressman asked recently on his national show on MSNBC, repeatedly, is Bush an idiot? But the Congress has not been much better at this point, with too many elected officials, including Democrats, focused impotently in a business-as-usual way on the November 2006 elections, trying to duck the reality that we face an existential crisis now. Linda just launched a new initiative today to address this problem, which I'm sure we'll take up on the show. Now, in this conjuncture, in this crisis, many leading people worldwide are waiting to hear what Lyndon LaRouche will say this coming Wednesday in his webcast. So with us today on the LaRouche Show, we have Helga Zepp LaRouche, the chairman of the German political party, the BUSO, and also the wife of Mr. LaRouche. She has lectured and written extensively on these kinds of global strategic policy crises, the need for a change in thinking. And she's been at the center of the fight, the center of a number of crucial fights, that for a new Bretton Woods monetary system, for a new Silk Road, the Eurasian land bridge, as part of a Eurasian development perspective to get out of this crisis. And she has also revived the highest philosophical principle of statecraft, the idea of the Peace of Westphalia, as the basis for rescuing our planet from a geometry of war and depression and establishing instead a new era of peace and development. So, Helga, it is a great pleasure to welcome you to the LaRouche Show.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
I'm fine. And we'll be joined by two members of a LaRouche Youth Movement panel, Gabby Arroyo from Boston and Nicole James, who is in Washington, D.C. Now, as I indicated, Helga, this is an extraordinary situation. So let's start from the top. Why is this such a dangerous moment in history?
Well, I think that you have the coincidence of two fundamental crises. One is that the global financial system is about to blow out, and those people who look at the record of Lyndon LaRouche, my husband, they cannot fail to acknowledge that when Lynn makes a fundamental prognosis, they better listen. Because Lynn was the first and only person, to my knowledge, who in 1958 made the prognosis that if the then existing beginning of a monetarist policy in the United States would be continued, it would lead to a new depression. He reiterated that warning when he saw certain cultural paradigm shifts occurring in the 60s with the rock, drug, sex counterculture, which many people who are now in their baby boomer age and so forth like, because it was the hippie period, it was the period of, you know, liberation in sexual terms and marijuana and other drugs. But Lynn recognized that that so-called shift in the cultural paradigm would in the long term lead to the destruction of the society. And that's exactly what we are seeing today in the so-called G8 or G7 countries, that you have as a long consequence of paradigm shifts which took place starting in the end of the 50s, but especially the 60s, 70s, the 80s, the hostile takeovers of the Reaganomics and Thatcher economics, and then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the unrestricted globalization. So you had two parallel processes. One was, you know, liberalization in economic terms away from a society of producers towards a society of post-industrial fantasies of speculation, and that being accompanied with cultural changes where the morality of society was undermined step by step by step. So when Lynn is saying we are now looking at the end phase of a systemic crisis, he is not talking about only the housing bubble blowout. Even that is making the headline news now in all the European media. I mean, you have a real panic, you know, predictions in the financial press saying, you know, the housing bubble in the United States is going to be the beginning of the end, because that will lead to a dollar collapse, the absolute inability to maintain the deficits, the budget deficit, the current account deficit, the trade deficit of the United States. And that will then lead to a dollar collapse, and then in turn you will have a collapse of the Asian exports to the United States, the Chinese, the Japanese, the South Korean, but also the European exports into the United States. So then these economies will collapse. Then as a consequence of that, hedge funds will go belly up. Private equity funds will not make it. So we are looking from the financial standpoint at the end of a very long, decade-long process of destruction. But that is not the only thing, because you have at the same time a systemic crisis, which means that all existing institutions, what people thought and believed would be, you know, cut in stone forever, pension systems, health systems, all of this is collapsing. But I think what you have in addition to that, and that I think is a very big element in that, is you have a moral collapse, which is most manifest in the complete decadence of the upper 20%, you know, of the of the population. And I think this is the same thing in the United States as well as in Europe. But, you know, naturally, then you have the phenomena of the maybe 0.5% of the really top people, those people who think that they're running the world through some oligarchical super funds. And, you know, they're about to really crush civilization against the wall. Mm-hmm. And I think we are looking at the coincidence of a financial crash and a strategic crisis, which is threatening to go out of control. And you cannot separate what is happening in Israel and Lebanon and between the Israelis and the Palestinians and what is possibly, you know, happening with Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. And, you know, you cannot separate the strategic crisis from the end phase of the collapse of the system.
Well, Helga, so, this is what I'd like to ask you then to elaborate, because a number of people are coming to realize that they're talking about a recession, they're talking about slowing economy. I don't think these so-called economists and economic commentators have yet taken into account what you just identified as the basis for Lynn's forecast. However, a lot of people then will hear that and say, well, but what does that have to do with the strategic crisis? Don't we have to protect ourselves from the so-called terrorists? So how do you see this connection between this global financial systemic blowout and the danger of spreading asymmetric warfare up to and possibly including nuclear war?
Well, I mean, people have a very short memory. Therefore, you know, they all of a sudden say, oh, we have these Muslims. And if you listen to Rumsfeld and Cheney, who made these unbelievable remarks a couple of days ago, where I think it was Cheney who said they want to create an empire from Spain, North Africa, Near East, Middle East, South Asia, all the way to Indonesia. Well, if you say they, well, that's more than 1 billion Muslims. Do you really want to say every person of a Muslim religion is a terrorist, or even worse, as they are now saying, a fascist? I mean, that's complete insanity. So let's go back and look where all of this is coming from. Because, you know, for the entire post-war period, you had the East-West conflict, and the Soviet Union, you know, was supposedly the big enemy. Now, when the Soviet Union started to disintegrate, you know, which Lin had predicted, by the way, you know, in 1983 for the first time, and again in 1988, when nobody was talking about the Soviet Union collapsing, so people should really pay attention to the record of prognoses of Lin. In any case, when the Soviet Union had disappeared, just think back, 1989, the wall came down, you know, there was no more enemy. The Soviet Union had disappeared. So there was the unique chance to put the East-West relationship on a completely different basis and create a peace order for the 21st century. Exactly at the point when that would have been a possibility, the neocons in the administration of the old Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Pearl, these people, they came up with the New American Century Doctrine, and they said, well, now that the Soviet Union is gone, is the ideal opportunity to turn the United States, which was founded as a republic, into an empire. And then they followed the crazy ideas of Leo Strauss, which, you know, basically the so-called Platonist philosopher from Chicago, who was a proponent of the idea that you always need an enemy relationship to mobilize people. So when the Soviet Union disappeared as an enemy, these people came up with the idea that since the East-West conflict no longer existed, that you had to replace it with the North-South conflict. And what is in the South? Well, you have Islam. So at that point, they said, okay, now we have to make Islam the enemy. And do not underestimate the amount of manipulation by the British, by certain forces in the United States and others in the Muslim community, because how did the radical Muslim development occur? It was Brzezinski who in 1975 proposed to a meeting of the Trilateral Commission in Tokyo to use the so-called Islamic card in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union.
Well, Helga, this is just a replay, in a sense, of the old theory of Mackinder and others, British geopolitics, the great game, a replay after the end of the Cold War.
Yes, exactly. No, but it was the idea to basically use Islam against the Soviet Union, which they did. They built the Quran schools. They made the radical versions of Islam in the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And after 10 years, when they could not succeed to defeat that force and the Soviet Union collapsed, well, these Muslim networks continued to exist in Central Asia, in Chechnya, in Pakistan. So in a certain sense, you know, these networks are not so independent of Anglo-American origin than people would make. For example, one question which, you know, occurred to me in the last days, I said, where the hell is Bin Laden? There is no more talk about Bin Laden. He was the big enemy. And now, well, you know, I think it's just one of these interesting things we should not forget.
Yes, well, there's a lot that I think Rumsfeld and Cheney would like people to forget. I think this brings us back to this question of so-called Islamic fascism, which I'd like to take up in just a second. You're listening to Helga Zepp LaRouche, who is our guest today on The LaRouche Show, and she'll be discussing a number of topics which will be included in recent publications, the LaRouche Pack white papers that are coming out. So we'll give you a phone number a little later that you can call to get literature. Also, we're discussing Lyndon LaRouche's historic webcast, which will be taking place this Wednesday, September 6th, at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And people will want to pick that up on LaRouchePack.com. Now, you mentioned the Rumsfeld-Cheney statements, this discussion of so-called Islamo-fascism. And I understand that this morning Lyndon LaRouche has launched an initiative to get to the real truth here, because they're accusing everyone who opposes their desire for this new Anglo-American global empire. They're saying anyone who opposes that is an appeaser. And what Lynn suggested is that we demand that the Congress look into this question of who the real appeasers are. Do you have something to say on that, Helga?
Well, I think it is really very, very dangerous because, you know, to label 1 billion or actually more than 1 billion people fascist, it is really, you know, in a certain sense, you know, going to, if this policy is continued, you will have a clash of civilization exactly like the evil Samuel Huntington, who, after all, we should not forget, already in 1957 in his book The Soldier and the State, was hailing the Allgemeine SS as a model for mercenary armies. So Samuel Huntington, who is really one of the evil spirits, if this would happen, that you blame or label more than a billion people Islam or fascist, that's the end of civilization. You plunge into a dark age. So the real problem today is not that fascism is in the Muslim world. The real danger is that you have right now actually in the middle of something which is much worse than a depression, much worse than the depression of the 30s, namely you have a real collapse of the physical economy, of the currency systems, of the financial system. You have certain oligarchical forces, financial forces, who want to implement a fascist order on the world. And, you know, if you fascism, Lynn always uses this image of the slime mold. You know, I saw a movie once about the slime mold, and it's really fascinating how this kind of a mushroom takes different forms and shades and colors and so forth, but it never changes its true nature. So when we are talking about fascism today, it's not going to be Mussolini, Franco, Hitler, or something like that, but it is the fascist policy which Franklin D. Roosevelt gave once a very beautiful definition when he said that if a small group of financiers determine the policy instead of the government, then you have fascism. And that's exactly what the danger is today. And, you know, it goes back really a long time because, for example, in 1968, George Ball, who at that point I think was the boss of Lehman Brothers and he was undersecretary of the Treasury at a certain point, he said that the nation state, the sovereign nation state, should be replaced by what he called a world firm. And that was the early articulation of a policy which, you know, has been elaborated since a lot by such people as Felix Rohatyn and John Kornblum, who all wear Laissez Faire, and Rohatyn is now with Lehman Brothers, which is very interesting. What they have developed is this idea that in the age of globalization, you do not need sovereign nation states anymore, because they can defend the common good, you know, so that you want to get rid of them. But what you want instead is corporate global identities. You want top managers of a few cartels who run the world and who implement ruthlessly the privileges of a tiny group of people who are so filthily rich that it becomes absurd. I think I read a statistic the other day that I think 300 people own more than 50% of the physical assets of the world. So it's the idea that these kinds of people, that they run super mega firms, you know, like cartels, like exactly in the 20s and the 30s when, you know, he had a process of violent hostile takeovers, and these were the firms which at that point, you know, financed Mussolini and Hitler. And you have the same process right now where you have a complete process of hostile takeover of, you know, ever bigger firms in every area. You can go to raw materials, to steel, to banking, to hedge funds. And that is where the danger of fascism comes from. So the people who are taking, you know, bribes and let themselves be financed in their political campaigns, they are the appeasers. So the real danger of fascism today is not, you know, not some masses of people who, you know, believe in Allah, but it's coming from these supranational firms which, you know, want to really implement their, it's actually a neo-feudal world order, because if you privatize everything in the hands of just maybe a couple of dozens of super, super mega firms, and they don't care about how continents live. Look at Africa. Mm-hmm. Africa right now is a dying continent. Let me just tell you, I don't know if this is being reported in the media in the United States, but you know, the thing which really is so upsetting is that you have right now, in this year alone, I think 20,000 people coming to the Canary Island by boat, about the same number to Sicily by boat. Half of them or more have drowned. So people are fleeing from hunger, from epidemics, from disease, from Africa. And, you know, in a certain sense, this is the breakdown of civilization. And that's the result of globalization. And there you can see what fascism is in a new form.
I just want to extend this thought for a moment. So we'll be getting with the LIM panel, getting them on after the half hour. So just to draw this to a full conclusion on the question of fascism, you mentioned George Ball. He was one of the promoters of radical depopulation. And my first knowledge of your involvement politically came from your intervention in a major event, I believe, in Romania, taking on one of the grand priestesses of this depopulation. So in a sense, what we're seeing is that the zero growth, zero population growth movement of the 60s, which is part of this baby boomer generation, is precisely what we're seeing, how it's exactly fulfilling what Lynn LaRouche said their intention was, which is global fascism. Why don't you just draw that further from this question of Africa and depopulation overall?
Well, you know, it is funny, because if people, you know, if people had a better memory, they would remember that in 1945, there was a clear idea, never again. I mean, it was really a commitment among all decent people that never again would there be fascism. And that, in a certain sense, lasted in the 50s, in the 60s, where the idea was that eventually you would overcome underdevelopment in the so-called developing countries. In the United Nations, you had development decades under the UN General Secretary U Thant. There was the idea that every decade, you know, the undeveloped parts of the world would improve and eventually they would, you know, be developed. There was a clear idea that that would happen. And then, you know, when the paradigm shift occurred, which Lynn is talking about all the time, the sex, rock, truck culture, the neoliberal changes and so forth, they introduced this idea of overpopulation. And since you're mentioning the conference in Romania, that was in 1974, the UN Population Conference, in which basically John D. Rockefeller III, Margaret Mead, and some others introduced the idea that there would be overpopulation and that you had to basically, you know, stop that, have population control and so forth. The funny thing is, in 1974, the brainwashing of the population had not yet occurred. So all the different NGOs and other groups who were there, also apart from the governments, they said, oh, overpopulation is a Rockefeller baby. because everybody knew this was an invention of Rockefeller, and, you know, I intervened very, you know, I mean, I made myself heard in telling these people what I thought of them. but, you know.
You usually don't have a problem with that, Helga.
What?
You usually don't have a problem with that.
No, actually, I enjoyed myself, and Margaret Mead was running after me with her stick, which was an icy stick. In any case, you know, but the point was that that introduction of that idea that there was supposedly to be overpopulation and not real development but sustainable development, well, you better look at what happened at in the same year when Henry Kissinger was the head of the National Security Council in the Nixon administration, where he wrote the infamous NSM 200 paper, in which, you know, he said, well, essentially all raw materials belong to the United States, or better, you know, a certain faction in the United States, and therefore we should make sure that those countries who do have raw materials, that they do not have too many people. So the U.S. government should use the food weapon to convince these governments to cut their population. You know, we shouldn't say it publicly because, you know, it's not so diplomatic. We should all cover it up nicely, but essentially that's it. So in a certain sense, you know, the very idea of the, you know, targeting of third world countries for destruction, of not allowing that they would really become developed, that is a long-term policy, you know, and that's the essence of fascism. And I think what is happening with Africa right now is willful genocide. I'm sorry. I mean, it would be so easy. It would be so easy to stop that, because you could develop Africa with a pen of a stroke. You could build bridges. You could build roads, railways, desalinization, irrigation. Africa could be turned around in half a year if there would be a will. You could stop hunger and disease in Africa in a couple of months, because most countries have tremendously fertile earth, and you just put drain and water on it and it grows 3-4 harvests per year. So that it's not being done. Nobody can tell me, you know, that that this is a destiny, but it is a willful policy. So, you know, in a certain sense, we are looking really... and it's just because people have forgotten that they're human, that they don't see it. How can, I'm sorry, I have a lot of Afro-American friends in the United States. Some of my best friends are Afro-American. But I have not seen that they care about Africa.
Well, and Helga Zephyrush is known for her global fight for precisely these kinds of development programs. We're going to take a short station break, and we'll be back on The LaRouche Show. The LaRouche Show is heard live on the web every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you don't hear it live, if you miss it, you can go to the LaRouchePub.com website and scroll over to where you see The LaRouche Show, and you can hear this show. You can play it for your friends. You can listen to some of the back shows. I think all the old shows are archived there. Now, I mentioned earlier that people can get literature. Let me mention one other thing first, though. If you have an email question for Helga, you can send it to us today at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And if we can't get to it on the air today, I think we can ensure that Helga will respond to you. So send us your emails. If you want literature, you want to be involved in the mobilization for this webcast coming up on Wednesday, call us at 800-929-7566 and leave your name and phone number, and we'll get back to you with literature. This is a crucial moment in history as we're discussing, and it's essential that people stand up and fight to restore the traditions of the American Republic and ensure that we win this fight so that never again does have some real meaning. So we're back on the LaRouche Show. Let me bring on our LIM panelists. The first person we'll hear from is Nicole James, who's been in Washington, D.C. for a number of months. And I know, Nicole, you're preparing for a week of action and organizing surrounding the webcast. Why don't you give us a report on what we're doing and what kind of response you're getting to Lyndon LaRouche's initiatives?
Yeah, well, over the last the last month, we've been going into New York City, which has been interesting because, you know, Congress has been out of session, so we've been going right where Felix Rahatan lives and bumping into a lot of his banker friends and stuff. So it's been pretty interesting. We had a rally the first trip in front of Roatan Associates with a big banner that said, get rid of the Nazi penetrator, Felix Rahatan. And so we had a huge response. Nicole,
I guess that's when he decided to shut down the company.
Yeah, pretty much. He had about like 50 bankers outside with their cell phones trying to figure out how to get us kicked off the sidewalk, but they didn't succeed. And this last New York trip, we then went after his new, the new rock that he's hiding under, Lehman Brothers, and we had a rally around the whole building. And a lot of the bankers were saying, well, we heard, you know, this guy Felix Roatan just came in last week, but we didn't know he was a Nazi. So we had this huge banner that it had a picture of a rat with Roatan's face on it, and there's a flashlight flashing on the rat with LaRouche's name written on the flashlight, kind of exposing it. And the banner said, different logo, same Nazi policies, Roatan, see how he runs. And it got a really good response. A lot of people took the literature. We got out LaRouche's webcast, and people definitely want to see what LaRouche is going to say on how we're going to get Congress back in shape by November. And as you know, this week of action, which is coming up this next week, Wednesday is going to be the first day that Congress is going to be back in session. So we're going to hit there with 70 youth, go to each office, tell them how we destroyed Roatan. And if they don't listen to us, they, you know, the Congress might be heading in the same direction that Felix is. But I wonder, is there time for me to ask Helga a question at all?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. I had a question on this recent interview in the last EIR with Ben Ari, who's, you know, one of the top military intelligence officers, former. He was bringing up the question of the threat that comes around introducing Madrid 2 for Omerit, the current prime minister, and just saying that because his position is being attacked right now, and that the population in Israel is completely freaked out based off of the Lebanon invasion, he was saying that that him making the move to push for the Madrid 2 conference could immediately push him out of the government and replace him with Netanyahu. I was wondering if there was a similar situation around the Treaty of Westphalia, in terms of the risk that's involved with actually implementing the solution.
Well, I mean, the problem in Israel right now is indeed that there are so many scandals hitting everybody from President Katsav to different members of the cabinet of the Olmert government, Olmert himself, that around the budget decision, that indeed, you know, all these things could lead to an emergence of Netanyahu as the president. Netanyahu refused to join a coalition with Olmert by saying he doesn't want to be helping him, he wants to replace him. And if Netanyahu would come in, then indeed we would be in a different danger right now, because, you know, he definitely would go for an escalation of the attacks against Hezbollah, Syria, Iran, and so forth. That risk does exist, but if you don't do it, it's almost 100% certain that the whole thing will blow up anyway, because, you know, the reason why Lynn is putting so much emphasis on this webcast, you know, and in a certain sense, when Lynn says, this is going to be the most important webcast I have ever done, and the world will not be the same after I have done it. Well, I have seen Lynn making similar prognoses, and, you know, then, you know, people were, how can he say this and so forth. But It is the coincidence. Remember that this whole thing is taking place in the onset of the financial crash. And the situation in the Middle East is not to be explained by Israel or by Lebanon or by any country in the Middle East, but it is, I mean, just think that, you know, if you really think about the world situation, you can see that these mega firms, these super cartels, have more power than nation states. So why would you think that it is nation states who cause wars to happen? What is very difficult for people to understand is that in this situation, Israel is just a pawn. It's like a hand grenade being thrown to accomplish a different aim. In the same way, like there is now a big debate in the region that with the Lebanon war, there was a complete failure of Israeli intelligence. They underestimate the strength of the Hezbollah. Now there is a big debate, you know, from leading Israeli generals who say, you know, actually the war should have been stopped after 3 days because at that point the Lebanese government agreed to a ceasefire. But then, you know, there is now a debate that they were pushed by the neocons to continue the war, to go into a complete meaningless destruction of the infrastructure of Lebanon and so forth. So in a certain sense, there is a crisis in Israel right now because the mythology that Israel is militarily undefeatable has been shattered. So in a certain sense, you know, I mean, forget Israel as such. It is not Israel. It is the question of who is pushing the war and why. And then you come to the point that, you know, the mega players, the really big ones, they know perfectly well that this system cannot be maintained the way it is. And they basically say, okay, we do not want to have a protectionist impulse. This is exactly what this ridiculous successor of Greenspan, Bernanke, was saying at the Jackson Hole bankers meeting in Wyoming just a week ago, where he said, well, you know, globalization is a wonderful thing. We are in the tradition of the Roman Empire, of the trading companies of the Dutch and the British in the 16th century, of the British Empire of the 19th century. And the biggest danger, according to Bernanke, is a protectionist impulse around the world, but especially in the United States. So that is really what they want to avoid. They want to crush the defense of sovereign nations, of their populations and the common good, and they rather throw the world into chaos and positioning themselves that they own and control strategic raw materials and, you know, energy and so forth, and then run the world through chaos. I mean, look, world wars do not happen just for rational reasons. I mean, World War I and World War II were largely because of geopolitical interests, but also of crazy ideologies. And that is what the danger is. And that is why Lynn is putting so much emphasis that he is going to shake the world with this webcast. Because he says people must understand, you know, what are the alternatives. And I have some inkling of what he is going to say, but I'm not going to reveal it because it's his show. So, you know, he will also speak very powerfully on, you know, the perspective for the next 50 years of the planet. And, you know, it is absolutely possible that if we can change the United States, there are right now very promising signs of forces in the world who want to have a more livable world. There are essentially two blocks of countries working together for cooperation. One is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's essentially Russia, China, the Central Asian countries, and then you have India, Pakistan, Iran, Mongolia as future members associated with that. And these countries go for joint economic development. And then the second block you have is the countries around, you know, Kirchner in Argentina, Lula in Brazil, even Chavez in Venezuela, now the situation with Obrador in Mexico, around Mercosur, and these countries want to have joint economic development projects for Latin America. Now, what is the solution? The solution would be that the United States stops to dream to be an empire and run the world, like Cheney and Rumsfeld are proposing, and that the United States goes back to the policy of John Quincy Adams, who had this beautiful foreign policy conception of an alliance of perfectly sovereign nation states who are working together for a community of principle. So what that would mean today is that if the United States says, okay, we do support the economic and infrastructural integration of Eurasia, the Eurasian land bridge. We support the infrastructure and economic integration of Latin America, and then we have meaningful trade relations. Well, then the United States could revive its economy. It could start rebuilding its infrastructure, its middle-level industry, and it could export with American technology and help the development of the Southern Hemisphere, and we would have a completely manageable world. Now, there is only one voice so far who is speaking like that, and that is my beautiful dear husband, Lyndon LaRouche, and who is loved by many countries around the world because he is regarded as the only voice of reason in the United States. And you can be sure, and I can only encourage you, listen to this webcast, because we have been doing some work, you know, telling people in Russia, in China, in India, in the Arab world, that this webcast is going to take place. And we already are flooded by emails of very important institutions from these countries who express their esteem and regard of Mr. LaRouche. And I can assure you, these countries have no higher desire than that some Democrats and some moderate Republicans would say, okay, let's put the United States back on the tradition of the American Constitution, of the American Revolution, of the Founding Fathers, of Lincoln, and then we will happily be working together with the United States. But, you know, I really think that it has to come from the United States, and there have to be some forces in the United States who stop to be gutless wonders and, you know, basically say LaRouche is the greatest son we have in our time. So let's work with him.
So that webcast, again, is this Wednesday, September 6th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. That's 9 Central. It's 7 a.m. Pacific Time. I'll be out in Los Angeles, and I'll be up bright and early with a large number of LaRouche Youth Movement members to listen to the webcast then. Also, Helga, I just want to pass on to Lynn our best wishes for his upcoming birthday. That's another event that we take note of here.
Okay.
Now, Gabby, hold on, because I'll be coming to you in a second, but there was something you brought up in answering Nicole's question about the risks involved in pursuing peace that borders on what you might call a deeper underlying philosophical question, a false axiom that many people have that's often put out by the neocons. They'll say that as in the Peace of Westphalia, the idea is that you can have peace between sovereign nation states based on the principle of the benefit of the other. Well, neocons say there's no such thing as the benefit of the other. There's only self-interest. How do you answer that, Helga?
Well, I think that we are not termites, and we are not, you know, crocodiles, and we are not other reptiles of that sort. I think you probably would have a hard time to convince a crocodile to be interested in the interest of a rabbit or some other fish when it's hungry, you know. But that's not exactly my ego ideal. I don't want to be a crocodile. I think that the human being is, you know, something completely different. I mean, in a certain sense, what makes us human is exactly the ability to find joy when the other is benefiting, when the other is growing. You know, and I think, you know, that the only way how civilization will come out of this crisis is if we remember and come back to our own humanity. And I believe since a very long time, and I'm working for this very hard, that nations and peoples must relate to each other like members of families. For example, when a father is happy that his son is growing in terms of his cognitive powers. When a mother is happy that her daughter is acquiring skills and knowledge, and you know, and the grandmother is happy that the grandchildren are, you know, developing new insights into the laws of the universe, that they're having tremendous skills as composers and poets and so on. Well, that emotion, when you see that members of your family are doing well, I mean, not materially, but, you know, especially from the standpoint of their character, their soul, their human personality and so forth, why can we not apply that principle to the relationship to other nations and other cultures and other people? There were periods in which this was possible, and these were the periods in which mankind progressed. Just think about, you know, how you know, mankind came out of the Dark Ages in the Abbasid period, in the collaboration between Harun al-Rashid and Charlemagne, which overcame the Dark Age of the Roman Empire. Or if you think how in the Italian Renaissance, that spirit of, you know, collaboration dominated for a certain period, or in other periods when, you know, indeed the Peace of Westphalia ended a terrible religious war, which, you know, had gone so far that, you know, at the height of the 30 Years' War, up to 60-70% of Europe, Germany in particular, were destroyed. So people recognized that if they keep it up to just kill each other, there's nobody left to enjoy the remains. So I think, you know, in a certain sense, you know, people who think that there is no interest of the other to be pursued, they're just not human by their own self-definition. And, you know, I believe that Confucius was right, and also Lessing, a German poet of the 18th century, that you can switch on love if you decide so. And all the Christians should do that.
Well, I think that would be make the world a much, much better place. Gabby, thanks for being so patient. Gabby Arroyo is joining us from Boston. Do you have a report on what we're doing in Boston around preparing for the webcast, or do you have a question for Helga?
Yeah, I have both.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, in light of the political situation, we have been trying to, we've been going to a lot of campuses that are starting to open up, especially Northeastern, Lynn's old university. So it's been fun. We've been trying to create an environment there of intellectual hegemony, essentially working on bringing the ideas of economic animations. We just finished the new astronomy here. So we've been taking that to the campuses already and hypothesizing how we're going to use that to communicate economics to these guys. And also hitting up places like the Kennedy School of Government, other institutions like that. So, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that the population is pretty polarized, and we're running into a lot of people that are familiar with us and are seeing Lynn as the only voice of reason.
Gabby, let me ask you a question. When you go to the Kennedy School of Government, do you have a sense that the professors there and the students there have an inkling of the depth of the crisis that Helga's been describing on the show?
No, not really. I mean, some of them have a very academic sense of it. I think the ones that are willing to be a little bit more honest tend to be tinted by pessimism, though.
So there's still a bit of a bubble on the academic community.
Yeah, it's pretty heavily rooted there.
Yeah.
But I did have a question. Is there time for that?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, Helga, I think because people don't have a real sense of history, sometimes they misconstrue or they skew the idea of what's possible, like what is determining the potential for something to happen. So I was wondering if maybe you could go through that in light of the Treaty of Westphalia, because at that time you did have a heavy influence from Venice. And what are the implications of that today? Like, how can that be unleashed?
How do you overcome the oligarchy, Helga?
Well, I think that, you know, actually a real statesman can always change history. But there are clearly periods where it is more tedious and more difficult than at other moments. There are historical conjunctures which apply for axiomatic intervention. And then, you know, it is a question, is there a leadership with vision how to intervene in such a moment? I think these, I have called them star hours of history. They don't come every 5 minutes, but maybe they come once a century or, you know, maybe twice a century or something like that. And, you know, in a certain sense, you know, I have talked about and written about the lost chance of 89 in terms of the German unification. Even if the situation was very difficult then, it would have been possible to completely change the situation. I mean, this is a, you know, this is one of my really, you know, I mean, the things I still I still don't accept that chance was missed. The chance then was when the communist system collapsed. It would have been possible to put in a completely different order. Now, in a certain sense, you know, what is happening now, and that's why Lynn is focusing on the September 6th webcast in the way he does, what is coming now is a collapse of much, much wider implication than the collapse of communism in 89. Because if people like it or not, the system of globalization is much more bankrupt than even the DDR was in November 89 or the Soviet Union between 89 and 91. So, you know, in a certain sense, you can say, oh, my God, the system is collapsing, or maybe I don't believe it, but maybe if Mr. LaRouche is correct and it is collapsing, it's a terrible catastrophe. But I don't think so. I think this system is so rotten and so unjust and is causing so many millions of people to die that in a certain sense, it's good if the system comes down, because the sooner it comes down, the better. The only question is, do people have a contingency plan for what to do? And therefore, I think what Lynn is trying to push in the United States, to go back to the president of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the New Deal, the Bretton Woods, these are historical precedents which do exist. And, you know, if the in a sufficient amount of people and forces in the Democratic Party, some Republicans, some other institutions, the, you know, diplomats, the intelligence community, the retired military, if enough people really say, you know, okay, this system was a terrible mistake, we are not involved in the groupthink, you know, because, you know, if you ask yourself the question, why do civilizations and cultures go under? It is always because you have the equivalent of a baby boomer syndrome, maybe not as bad as the baby boomers, but you always have the problem that the leadership does not get their act together to analyze what is the problem in time and to have a contingency plan how to remedy it in time. And I think what Lynn wants to catalyze with this webcast, among many other things he's doing, but especially with this intervention, is he wants to catalyze among especially the leadership circuits in the United States, those who are not neocons, that they get their act together, that they go to the tradition of FDR, that they make a contingency plan, and they put it in the Congress, in the Senate, and they act. Because, you know, it's a very short window of opportunity. You know, history is full of such situations where you could change history for the better for maybe a day or a week, and then it's gone. And we are approaching very, very rapidly. I mean, with the, you know, five hurricane, you know, we are approaching the collapse of the system. And Lynn wants to shake people up that they think what can be done and what must be done. So I think it's, you know, in a certain sense, the oligarchy, you know, will be contained in the moment when the majority of nations get together in the world and say, we want to have a system where we as people and nation can live. And then the oligarchy can be contained. The oligarchy is not so many people. It's maybe altogether the real big ones. I would think it's not more than 1,000 people.
Helga, we're getting some emails in toward the end of the show. We now have less than 6 minutes, so I'm going to make sure they get forwarded to you to look at. But I wanted to bring up a question toward the end of the show. We've seen some very interesting developments in recent months in Germany around the work that you've done, the Busso has done, the campaigns, and now we have a campaign for mayor of Berlin. It seems to me that the attendance of institutions, German institutions, has been increasing at the webcasts. And so many people who had thought, well, you'll never get motion out of Germany, Helga's just too optimistic to believe. It's obviously the case that things are changing. Could you say something about that?
Well, we are running right now a very exciting campaign with Daniel Buchmann as the leading candidate for the reindustrialization of Berlin. And we are the only party who is doing that. All the other parties, from the CDU, Christian conservative, to the left successor of the communist Linke lefty party, they all accept the system that you have to save, that you have to make austerity, that you have to go ahead with hedge funds and liberalization. They all are the same. And we are the only ones who say no. We want to create a million new productive jobs in Berlin. We want to make Berlin the center of Eurasian development. The next 50 years we'll see the integration of the Eurasian continent with Europe, Russia, Asia, China, India becoming, you know, basically population and industrial growth spots integrated through infrastructure corridors. And if that perspective prevails, then Berlin will be the door to Eurasia. And that idea has sparked really enthusiasm, and I'm actually optimistic that, you know, we can defeat the usual kind of cultural pessimism. And we have found a lot of people who say, we will vote for you because, you know, the idea that Berlin needs a future, that the youth of Germany need a future, I think it's catching on. So, no, I don't make predictions yet about the outcome, but this is a fantastic campaign, and you should see the poster. It's hanging all over Berlin, and it has a beautiful, very, you know, winning young man, Daniel Buchmann, and he says the future, the youth needs a future, and there is no argument against that.
Well, I think we should get some of those posters. I think they'd at least
absolutely
hang nicely in all of the LaRouche Youth Movement offices in the United States. Nicole or Gabby, do you have one last question? We've just got a little more than 2 minutes. Nicole?
Oh, yeah. I can't think of a question right now, actually.
All right.
Did you have one, Gabby?
No, I don't think I have.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll jump in here, Helga. With this webcast, I know that the world's attention is going to be focused on it. Can you say something in 1 minute about the situation in Mexico, which last night moved into a new state of ferment and potential with the blocking of the State of the Union address by President Fox by forces backing López Obrador? Do you have...
I think that is a sign of the times that, you know, Mexico, which did have successful revolutions in the past, is now in a process where I think the majority of people who have voted for Obrador are responding to his leadership. And I think it's important to see that if you have a leadership, then the population is more encouraged and courageous. And they understand that for Mexico, it's either a dark age, which is already visible, or it's a revolution going in the direction of real national sovereignty, economic development. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think the idea to, you know, block Fox, he capitulated, he didn't go into the parliament, he went home, he made the State of the Union address on the internet or through the TV. You know, but basically you have a dual power situation in Mexico right now. And Obrador said, well, you know, as long as, you know, we are representing the people, you know, we are not going to quit. So in a certain sense, that gives you the taste of the future that I think you see right now. You know, ironically, I think Bush will go into history as the big unifier of peoples, because he has catalyzed so much resistance around the world, you know, that he is doing a great job to further the cause of mankind.
He'll be good for something. Helga, thank you so much for joining us. The time just flew by today. Remember, Wednesday, September 6th, 10 a.m. Eastern, the LaRouche webcast on LaRouchePact.com. Thanks for joining us today on the LaRouche Show.